Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Full Cast and Crew podcast. I'm your host, Jason Silo, and I'm thrilled to be joined this week by my repeat guest, Brad Kane, who you may remember if you're a frequent listener. We did the Tim Burton film Ed Wood on the podcast some months ago. Brad has been active in Hollywood as an actor, a singer, a child performer. He's appeared in commercials, TV programs, films. He did the singing for Disney's Aladdin. He's currently working on an adaptation of Stephen King's It, which will be forthcoming as a limited run series. He's been a writer. He's just been around. And he's a great conversationalist and has a great appreciation for a wide variety of films and TV interests of the sort that I have. So it is my pleasure to have him on the pod to talk about Sunset Boulevard. I don't know how we ended up doing Sunset Boulevard, but I think we're falling into a bit of a routine where we're going to do films about making films. And Sunset Boulevard is arguably one of the most representative and important films of that genre. And our conversation branched off into a bunch of ancillary wormholes related to life in Hollywood, life as a writer, life as an actor, the auteur theory, directorial importance, assessing some of the films of Billy Wilder, sharing a few of the films that I watched adjacent to Sunset Boulevard. And it was a great conversation, and I'm happy to share it with you here. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Brad Kane about Sunset Boulevard. Brad, welcome back to the Full Cast and Crew podcast. I'm thrilled to have you back.
Thank you, Jason. I'm thrilled to be back. I love listening to the podcast. I love discussing film. I love discussing film with you. So
it's a trifecta.
It's great.
For people listening, if you enjoy what you're about to hear, you can seek out the previous episode that Brad and I did, which was on the brilliant Tim Burton film, Ed Wood, which we were both big fans of.
Yeah, it seems like we're creating a little niche for ourselves of just discussing between us movies about Hollywood, which is fine with me because I love movies about Hollywood.
Great. I mean, as you...
We'll do The Player next. Let's do The Player next.
I would love to do The Player. I think I covered The Player a little bit in a glancing Altman episode, but it's worthy of a deep, deep dive. I read a book about Sunset Boulevard that signals out The Player as maybe the best sort of movie about making movies. Although that book came out before Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which is a current and ongoing obsession of mine, but a lot of worthy films.
Yeah, I don't know if The Player is the best movie about making movies in Hollywood. I think The Player is the best movie about producing movies, for sure, and the, you know, very inside baseball of movies. But I think Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is really like the movie lover's movie about making movies.
Oh, man. I just posted today, today we're recording this on Thursday, March 14th. By the time the listeners get this, it will be the following week. But just this morning, my episode / obsession with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood continued because I posted my episode covering all of Brad Pitt's Cliff Booth scenes in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It's a 2-hour deep dive. So color me obsessed. I'm actually now mourning as if they're friends of mine, that I'm not going to be spending time with Rick Dalton and Cliff Booth the way I have over the last 4 weeks, obsessively watching and rewatching the film. I guess that's the mark of a great film, that you can always revisit it and either watch it actively or passively, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. They're you know, they feel like friends after a while. I mean, I've watched Once Upon a Time in Hollywood 3 or 4 times. Yeah. And it is, you know, it's one of those movies that obviously the first couple of times you just watch it, you're absorbed by it and you get sucked in by it. But it is one of those movies that, you know, if you do love that subject matter and you love Tarantino, you can put it on, you can walk away, you can come in, you can glance down, you can do other things. And it's just a friendly voice to have in the background as some people watch. I know you watch in a much more detailed way. Mm-hmm. You look at all the nuance, and I do too. But it's a comfort watch for me,
it
too.
Is.
It doesn't have to be Absolutely. As detailed a watch as the first few times. So,
and you know what I've been thinking about? Do you think Tarantino... I know, I mean, he's a thing. He's an entity. He's a successful Hollywood auteur. He made probably his greatest film. He's still getting better as a director. But when I watch Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, you know, the filmmaking, the shots, the pure cinematic stuff that's going on is so, so impressive and happening on the highest level. But it doesn't feel like people appreciate those films cinematically as much as they appreciate them as like, oh, it's a Quentin Tarantino joint. It's going to be a rollicking, fun ride, which is great. But I wonder if part of the reason performances like that in movies like that don't get nominated and rewarded all the time is because they don't people don't take them seriously, but I think they should.
I think it'll get its due. I mean, sometimes it takes, you know, yes, it's rollicking. Yes, it's a lot of fun. And it was appreciated in its time, maybe not in the awardsy way, even though he did win an Oscar, I think, for screenplay, didn't he? Didn't Tarantino win the Oscar for that one?
I don't know if he won for that one.
I think he did.
Did he? I would hope he did. Let me see.
He was nominated for sure.
I know Leo was not. Oh, well, no, Brad won the Oscar.
Oh, Brad won the Oscar, but Tarantino was definitely nominated for best screenplay.
Right.
I thought he won it, but I guess I'm wrong. I guess
I'm remembering. No, you're not wrong. We just don't know yet.
Oh, okay. but I think it's going to be revisited, you know, in time for its performances, for its craft. But it is such a rollicking good time of a movie that, you know, it can be appreciated for that right now, and that's fine.
He won best original screenplay for Django Unchained.
Oh, okay.
He received his first Best Picture nomination for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. So there you go.
Yeah.
Anyway, don't get me. I'm
not weeping for Tarantino.
I know.
He's gotten his flowers.
I know.
And he will be studied for decades to come.
I know. I'm not over the Oscars yet, Brad. I'm not over the snub of Leo.
I know. It's funny. You know, I listen to every single one of your podcasts. I really enjoy them. And I agree with you about half the time.
That's why you are an absolute perfect guest.
Yeah. I like arguing with you.
Okay.
At least in my head, we can't argue in person every time. But
no, that's fine. That's what I want.
Listen, we can talk about this. You know, before we get into Sunset Boulevard, this can be our preamble. But I enjoyed Killers of the Flower Moon very much for about the first hour and a half.
Mm.
I think it's a movie. At the highest level of its somebody working at the absolute height of their powers, craft-wise, but not necessarily, you know, sometimes it takes a neophyte and someone scrappy to make a truly great movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a very good movie, but I don't agree that it's one of his best.
Mm.
I think for any other filmmaker, it might be one of their best. I think for Scorsese, because his bench is so deep, I don't feel that way. There are many, many, many more Scorsese movies I like better than Killers of the Flower Moon. I do think, and again, you know, an artist would say, well, you know, like Mozart, you know, it's a little too long. You know, well, which notes would you like me to cut,
Sire? Exactly. Yeah.
You know, I think it's a little too long. And of course, an artist would say, well, it's no longer or shorter than it was required for me to tell my story. But as a viewer and as a viewing experience, I felt it got a little bit... repetitive in terms of the visceral trauma that's shoved in your face for 3.5 hours. I got it after about 2 hours,
mm-hmm.
and I felt he could have wrapped it up in a half hour of that. But these are quibbles, you know, and it also doesn't mean I'm right. It's just my particular take.
Well, I think more people probably agree with you than agree with me, but I do think... it's interesting because I had kind of the opposite reaction where I sort of wasn't with the film for the first hour and a half. And then I've never had that experience in a movie theater. Usually I'm the kind of guy, I'm sitting down in a movie theater. I can tell within 15 seconds, usually, if it's going to be good. I mean,
right.
Quite literally, I really think if you watch a lot of movies, you can kind of tell right away whether we're in good storytelling hands here or not. And with that film, I wasn't with it for the first hour and a half. And
right.
I was not prepared for the sledgehammer final third, which then completely transformed my experience of the film. And then, of course, I saw it several times more with that knowledge in hand, and that certainly informed my appreciation of the film. I wonder if that's just a truism about the film in a way, is like, maybe you do have to see it once to kind of get it, and then you can really appreciate the storytelling times two and three, because that was certainly my experience. I wonder, I think I misspoke when I did my Oscar recap. I said that it was a Netflix film, and that was part of perhaps the backlash, because certainly the Oscars this year is really about the rise of Universal Studios as the premier the premier film studio, where directors like Christopher Nolan are making really big films about weighty subjects and having them make $1 billion. And that's a old school theatrical model, as opposed to it's an Apple production, not a Netflix production in the case of Killers of the Flower Moon. I wonder, given that Marty is 0 for 20 on The Irishman and Killers of the Flower Moon, Irishman Netflix, Killers of the Flower Moon Apple, are we seeing a little bit of the industry circling wagons, as you said, in a tough time to say, hey, you know what? We're supporting the real theatrical experience here because we can't let our business continue to be eroded away by these streamers. I wonder if that's part of the Oscar snub.
It could be. I don't know. I mean, I'd hate to speculate. You know, I feel like we're in a time where really nobody knows anything, you know, and obviously the famous William Goldman quote, nobody knows anything, but it feels truer now than ever. And, you know, obviously in the last 5-6 years, all of the studios tried to jump on Netflix's coattails and figure out why they were, you know, the big glut of buying content and, you know, just making a billion shows just turned out not to be true. It turned out that you actually need a revenue source, you know, to actually make these things. They don't just generate it out of nothing. That's why commercials are coming back, you know, because they figured out that, oh, that model worked. So yeah, everybody's trying to figure out how to make money in this new economy. And I think art will always do okay. I don't think Scorsese's ever going to have a problem finding money to make his movies. But he's also not stupid. He's an old master, and he's making a movie, I guess, about Christ now. That's 90 minutes. That's not going to cost $250 million. So he got the memo. You know, right. He understands the assignment, at least for this next film going forward. And everybody's going to adjust in one way or another. And the other thing is, yes, maybe maybe Universal is the premier major Hollywood studio at the moment. You know, looking to make the great dramatic movies again and that sort of thing, but no shortage of great movies got made this year, you know, with other money. It was a great year for film, and you know, everybody was you know, crying out that it was the death knell for film with all of this streaming. It turned out absolutely to be untrue.
So
they're going to figure out new models. The studios are going to figure out how to make, you know, money, movies in the Christopher Nolan, here's $100 million for Oppenheimer, as opposed to the Apple, here's $250 million for something. Mm-hmm. And they'll make money off of that. They'll figure it out, you know, but artists aren't going anywhere, and Hollywood's not going anywhere. It's just an adjustment period.
And to your point of everything old being new again, and nobody knows anything, good segue into our discussion of Sunset Boulevard, a film that was one of the earliest statements about what we're talking about, the industry, what it does to the people who work within the industry, how it may discard people past a perceived sell-by date, the scrabbling that takes place within the barrel of the industry. This was one of the first films to really put all that on screen. And we've been talking about doing this for a number of weeks, so I was able to go down a pretty substantial Billy Wilder, Charles Brackett, IAL Diamond wormhole. At the same time, I coincidentally had been going down the wormhole of watching a bunch of 40s films, because it's an era I wasn't really as knowledgeable about. And I read an amazing book about Hollywood in the 40s called City of Nets, which I highly recommend to anyone interested in the making of movies and the business of the town. And that's the book that really got me watching some of these 40s films, because the book kind of posited that really in the 40s, you have the first kind of golden era of Hollywood, because you have stars, you know, who've been around for 20 years, let's say at that point, or even new stars from the dawn of the talking cinema. And so you have a whole coterie of artisans and actors in an industry that's grown up in talking cinema for about 20 years, and you've reached this first wave of kind of mastery over the form, and these films are representative of, I think, that era in an interesting way for me. So I've been really enjoying that. I'm trying to like wave the flag on the show's Instagram account to tell people, like, you know, don't sleep on some of these 40s films, because they're very different in tone, of course, than I think what I typically do here in films of the 70s or films about the 70s. But it's been amazing to go down and really appreciate the work of some of these writers and directors and performers. I find some great acting performances, even though it's, again, very different than what we like if we like naturalistic 70s movie acting. So,
well, what's interesting about what you're reading about the films of the 40s is that was also the golden age of film noir. And, you know, basically what Sunset Boulevard is at the dawn of the 50s is a meta commentary on film noir or a parody of film noir. And obviously Joe Gillis, being a screenwriter toiling Hollywood in the 40s, would have tried to break into writing film noir for the studios, because that was one of the big genres at the time. And ironically, film noir is, there's a lot of voiceover in film noir, you know, basically taking you through. And Joe Gillis gets to have a voiceover in Sunset Boulevard and take you through his life as a noir. So it's there's a lot of meta levels happening in this movie.
Yes, this is Sunset Boulevard, Los Angeles, California. It's about 5 o'clock in the morning. That's the homicide squad, complete with detectives and newspapermen. A murder has been reported from one of those great big houses in the 10,000 block. You'll read about it in the late editions, I'm sure. You'll get it over your radio and see it on television. Because an old-time star is involved. One of the biggest. But before you hear it all distorted and blown out of proportion, before those Hollywood columnists get their hands on it, maybe you'd like to hear the facts. The whole truth. If so, you've come to the right party.
I read a book about the making of Sunset Boulevard, and there is a great quote here. This is from a book, Close Up on Sunset Boulevard, Billy Wilder, Norma Desmond, and the Dark Hollywood Dream. And the author says, Sunset Boulevard, a glossary of visual, verbal, and film history in-jokes, can be read as a 110-minute punchline. That's because the art direction along with the script seems calculated to titillate, which I think is very true. Yeah. Tying that
it's,
back.
It's a grand guignol.
Yes.
It is.
Yes. And I'm reminded, mentioning Cliff Booth again, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, you know, in the novelization of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which I really like, Tarantino uses Cliff Booth as a mouthpiece for obviously what are Tarantino's own thoughts and beliefs about cinema and how it changed in post-war America, which is one of the more fascinating parts of the novelization. And part of what he's talking about is Cliff Booth comes back from World War II after having these intense experiences and seeing some serious shit, and goes to the movies as he loves to do. And he finds that even things like Sunset Boulevard don't work for him like they used to, because there's an artifice to it. There's a distance to it that he's finding, without being able to articulate it, doesn't fit for his sensibility anymore. And I think it's such an interesting way to sort of track that 50s to 60s thing that we're going to get to, and that in 1969, where Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is set, that's what they're wrestling with, is the death of this time period that really stems from the 40s through the 50s and the 60s in Hollywood.
Yeah, I think you can look at it like that. You can look at it like, you know, a grand guignol or the type of picture that, you know, went out of fashion or whatever. I think at its core, it's Billy Wilder's commentary on, and it's, I don't think it's exaggerated commentary, but it's his commentary on what Hollywood is like. And it hasn't changed. I'm here to tell you, it hasn't changed. 'Twas thus, 'twill always be so. And to that end, you so know, true. let me, can I tell you a little story?
Absolutely.
I'm gonna tell you a little story.
You're here to tell us stories. Go ahead.
It involves Mr. Wilder. So I, to some degree, I have been Joe Gillis. I am a screenwriter. You know, I have been a Hollywood screenwriter. I've been a hack. I've done many big studio film projects, you know, that have not gotten made. I've done some stuff that has gotten made. I've done a lot of TV that's gotten made. And I'm very lucky to be a working writer. So I am not Joe Gillis anymore, but I've been him. But when I first moved out to Los Angeles in the 90s, I had a sore throat. And I went to see a very famous, not famous, but a very well-known ear, nose, and throat doctor in Beverly Hills, a man named Joseph Sugarman on Beverly Drive. A lot of people went to him. And I went to see him. And his claim to fame is his brother was Danny Sugarman. And Danny Sugarman was the guy who wrote the very famous book, No One Here Gets Out Alive, right, about his time with the Doors, on the road with the Doors.
Right.
Anyway, so I went to Dr. Sugarman. And, you know, he gave me antibiotics and blah, blah, blah. And he asked me what I, you know, what I was there for, what I was in Hollywood for. And I said, well, I'm here to, you know, right now I'm acting, but I'm here to make films. I love movies. I went to film school, all this kind of stuff. And he said, oh, that's very interesting. No, I'm very into film. And a lot of my patients are, you know, directors and filmmakers and all this kind of stuff. Like, who's your favorite director? Like, who do you really love? And I had been watching The Apartment over and over and on a loop. And I said to him, oh my gosh, I'm just obsessed with Billy Wilder right now. He's just this old master, and his movies are so perfect, and they have great commentary, but they're also very commercial. He just knew what he was doing. And he says, that's so interesting. You know, Mr. Wilder is a patient of mine and a friend of mine. And I have lunch with him every once in a while. You know, he's in his 90s, but he's still sharp as ever. And I say, oh my God, that's incredible. He goes, would you like to have lunch with us someday? And I said, are you kidding? Yes, I would love to. So I leave. A couple of weeks go by. I don't even think about it again. I get a call from Dr. Sugarman. And he says, today's the day. You know, I'm having lunch with Mr. Wilder. Would you like to come and join us and eat with us? I said, sure. Where are you going? He said, well, we're going to the Beverly Hills Tennis Club, which, if you know anything about L.A., is like the old school 1940s, 1950s meeting spot.
Love it.
So I go and I go to Dr. Sugarman. He takes me in his car. We pull around. I don't know if anybody knows about Beverly Hills, but we pull around on a little street called Brighton Way, and we stop. It's one of the little streets, side streets of Beverly Hills. And we wait a couple of minutes, and I look towards this building, and out totters this old man, just tottering out with his, you know, little golf cap, and it's Billy Wilder, and it's unmistakably him. He's, you know, he's moving a little slower, but my God, there is the old master. And he gets in the car and he says, who are we dining with today? Who is this young man? Dr. Sugarman introduces me. I tell him I'm a fan. He goes, fan, blah, 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 blah. We'll talk like men. We get to the Beverly Hills Tennis Club. We sit down. It's 11:30 in the morning. The waiter comes up to us. It's just the three of us, Dr. Sugarman, Mr. Wilder, and myself. And the waiter asks, you know, what would you like to drink? They come to me first. And I say, oh, you know, I'll have an iced tea. I mean, it's 11:30 in the morning. Billy Wilder goes, ah, iced tea. This is water. Yeah, have a fucking martini. I don't know if I can curse on your show, but he did. Have a fucking martini. I go, I'll just have whatever you're having. So there we are, 11:45 in the morning. I'm having dirty martinis with Billy Wilder at the Beverly Hills Tennis Club. And for an hour and a half, he proceeds to eviscerate the movies of every current director in Hollywood. And it was just like one of these glorious moments that I will never forget. Like he had developed for many years Schindler's List. Mm-hmm. And Steven Spielberg's Schindler's List had come out only a few years old earlier. And he just destroyed it.
Really? Well,
in every direction.
I just read that Hollywood Reporter article about Steven Spielberg, you know, reminiscing about the making of Schindler's List. And in that article, he talks about how Billy Wilder called him and basically begged him to let him direct it when he was 92 or 90, probably at the same time. I mean, if the film had come out a couple of years before your story.
Yeah.
It's a really interesting story because, you know, obviously he has such a personal connection to the story. Whether he could have done it or not at that age, I don't know, but that's amazing. Now,
had a biting wit.
What did you have to wear? Did you ask Dr. Sugarman what you should wear to the lunch, or did you just know?
No, I mean, listen, it was the mid-90s. I was probably wearing flannel in L.A. I mean, I have no idea.
Well, if you're going to the tennis club, like, I would have thought, like, do I have to wear whites? Like, what's the, you know?
No, you didn't have to wear tennis whites to the Beverly Hills Tennis Club if you were dining with Mr. Wilder. I think, you know, I had free reign at that point. But, yeah, it's one of those memories that, like, I wish I could go back and relive because I know I appreciated it at the time, but I don't think I, you know, I don't think I was able to fully appreciate it at 23 years old as a new screenwriter or new filmmaker in Hollywood trying to make my way. It was pretty overwhelming.
But let me ask you this. Was there a part of you that wanted, were you disappointed that he was trashing current cinema in a way, or did you feel that was on brand in terms of your appreciation of him?
It felt pretty on brand to me. Like looking back to, you know, at all of the films he made, you know, The Lost Weekend, Sunset Boulevard, The Apartment, you know, Shut Up and Deal. These are very, you know, pretty biting films, mm-hmm. you know, and he was witty too. Yes, mm-hmm. he was trashing them, but he was trashing them in the most elegant and witty right. way. So, no, it was fine. That's Hollywood anyway. Yeah. Everybody trashes everybody.
I know. It just disappoints me in a way. I don't want people to be bitter. I know it's what it does to everyone, but I don't like when people are bitter or, you know, feel like they have to.
I don't
to.
Think he was bitter. I think when you get to, because he knew who he was and he knew what his filmography was. And yes, there's always the one that got away, whether it's Schindler's List or whatever. But, you know, he was 95 or something. And I'm sure everything hurt. And you want to complain at that age. And I don't blame him. I was just happy to be in his presence.
Yeah.
You know?
That's amazing.
No, that doesn't, that sort of thing doesn't, you know, his attitude does not dull the filmography in right. any way or take the shine off it.
Now, I was reading also in the book, and I, you know me, Brad. You know I'm a contrarian by nature.
I love it.
Part of what I'd like to accomplish here in this podcast episode is to at least put forth an opinion, which I developed after watching many of the films you just mentioned and others like Stalag 17 and A Foreign Affair, Witness for the Prosecution, just a bunch of amazing films that I really enjoy. But I read in this book that you have Brackett and Wilder is a construct at the time and is responsible for the screenplay of Sunset Boulevard, which is Charles Brackett, who is listed and credited as the producer, and Billy Wilder as the director. And much like the Coen brothers, who have a similar relationship sometimes where one of them is listed as the producer and the other is listed as the director and they write the films together, it's a smart thing you realize, and I think they mention it in this book, which is if you can have a situation where really it's the only people you have to really argue with about the film are each other as opposed to the studio or the other producers who are outside your close-knit bubble, right? That's a positive thing. And they had this relationship and they wrote a lot of screenplays together. And I'm going to read this paragraph here. It says, quote, the prevailing opinion now in books and articles on the career of Billy Wilder casts Brackett as second fiddle in the writing team. This shift, based on hearsay and fueled by auteurist wish fulfillment, has occurred in recent decades as a parallel to director worship. Prior to the 60s, those who thought about screenwriting at all would have looked on such an appraisal as strangely contrarian. It's important to emphasize that in the instance of Brackett and Wilder, virtually all critical opinion has come from outside. Neither man ever took credit for anything more than working hard to entertain. A certain old-school gentlemanliness made boasting taboo, just as it forbade referring to oneself as an artist. I think that's important to me because I do feel, I think, the influence of Wilder's writing partners on the screenplays of many of his most famous films. I feel the loss of Charles Brackett in some films later where he has different writing partners.
Well, Izzy Diamond was no slouch, though.
No slouch, but it's different. But to the point, I think with Wilder, there's a cult of the director. And I think a lot of the modern appraisal of Wilder ascribes, as they aptly put it here, the auteurist wish fulfillment. We have to remember that's a modern creation, really, of the cinema, the new wave cinema in France, right? Late 40s, 50s, 60s, and then bleeding over into America and having that take over a lot of the way, you know, literate film people would talk about films is putting a lot more emphasis on the director, as opposed to the way people thought about films in the 30s, the 40s, and the 50s.
Yeah, they were craftsmen. It was a working class town in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And that auteurist theory is something that Pauline Kael took mm-hmm. the piss out of with her, you know, with her reappraisal of Citizen Kane and saying that Herman Mankiewicz was just as responsible, if not more responsible, for that script. And so, yeah, there are a few different ways to look at it. I think it's a little bit more nuanced if we're talking about auteur theory. And I don't think Billy Wilder was an auteur or wanted to be seen as an auteur. But I will say, I do think he was the author of his films, because there is a signature, you know, style that pulls through even from Witness for the Prosecution all the way through Avanti, the 70s movies, as a Billy Wilder film. That doesn't mean all the scripts are the same or, you know, the dialogue is the same. He had, you know, he had partners and he acknowledged his partners. But I still think in many ways for film, the director, whether they wrote the movie or not, and this is coming from a screenwriter, which I'll probably get, you know, ridden out of town on a rail. But I do think the director in many ways is the author of a film in, you know, in certain ways. And I think that's okay, you know?
Well, they have to be in charge.
There's nuance.
They have to marshal all the resources in a direction which frequently is the direction they think best, whether they know best or not. It's just an organization needs a head, and the director is the head of the filmmaking organization.
Correct. And the writer is not always responsible for everything. Listen, we're fully ready to take credit if we're praised, you know, and the script is praised. But things get changed in the writing, in the story, by the director to tell the story the way he wants to tell it or she wants to tell it.
Right.
And it's, you know, it's they are the author of the film in a lot of different ways. And they're the ones who work with all the writer doesn't work with, you know, production design unless you're the producer on it. Maybe also the writer doesn't work with sound. The writer doesn't work with the editors. You know, the editors don't work with the costumes. The director is the one who wrangles all those things together and makes all the hard decisions that result in what you see on screen. And that's the truth. That's not auteur theory, but it still speaks to a director being the author to an extent of his films.
Now, with Sunset Boulevard particularly, as I'm watching it the first time in preparation for this, I'm sitting there with a very uneasy feeling, Brad, because I'm like, oh no. This is going to happen to me again, where I bring someone on the podcast to do a film that we're both very excited to do. And then I watch the film and I'm like, I don't really like this. This is not
interesting.
This is not really working for me. And now, of course, I know myself well enough to know that sometimes that can start to happen just because of this contrarian nature, which I told you about, which I'm aware of enough to know. Sometimes I have to just let that play itself out to get through it, to be open. And that can just be where I am in the day or when I'm happen to be watching the film or something I've read or what have you. But
was it the very heavy-handed first shot of the words Sunset
no,
Boulevard
I loved that.
Literally in the gutter?
No, I loved that. I loved that. I literally did. I was like, I'm in good hands here when I saw that shot. Okay.
Okay.
I think what it is, as you said before, I'm such a noir fan, both in what I read and what I watch, that I think the pastiche aspect of this for me is one of those things where I just know too much about the genre and I have sort of very firm likes and dislikes about the genre. So this to me is a bit like a film, or it's like a book where sometimes well-known authors will try their hand at crime fiction, right? And whenever I read that, inevitably, it is unsatisfying because they're not really of the genre the way the genre authors that I love writing crime fiction are. And in a way, this isn't really a film noir. It's certainly not a film noir the way Double Indemnity is, right?
It's a parody of a film noir.
It's necessarily a parody. I think it's more a pastiche because it's...
Okay.
It's not, fair. I don't think it's like a Mel Brooks comedy. You know what I mean? It's not going for that.
It is satire.
It is
whether
satire.
It's broad. I mean, Mel Brooks comedy is broad comedy. That's not quite apples to apples.
Right.
But it is a satire. Mm-hmm. And you can't deny that because Joe Gillis, you know, it's an ironic satire because Joe Gillis, who can't get a job writing film noir or anything that's going on in Hollywood, gets to be a character in his own film noir. Gets to, you know, this is probably the best writing Joe Gillis has ever done, this voiceover commentary.
And that's the problem. That's a problem for me because I'm listening to his voiceover. I'm like, this guy's so good at this. Like, he would be hired to write film noir if you could do that great of a voiceover. Now, I know.
But that's the irony.
I know.
You know, I mean, if you watch it as, you know, this is, and by the way, I think Wilder would have told you, this is supposed to be funny.
Right. Of course. You know? Of course.
Yeah. This is supposed to be ironic. This is supposed to be horrific and over the top in a way that, you know, but the irony of that is that it's also dead true. Right. So you watch it and you think this is supposed to be funny. This is over the top. This is a bad parody of film noir because it can't possibly be a real film noir. All of the answers to that are yes, 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 and yes. They're all, it's yes to all of those things. And I think Billy Wilder knew that. I think it's very self-aware.
Do you think, does she have to really have had a sexual relationship with a chimpanzee?
Is it alluded to that she had a sexual relationship with the chimpanzee?
Of course it is, Brad. Of course it is.
I don't know about that. I didn't read that, but maybe, you know, we see what we want to see, Jason. In life and in film.
No, there's been much written about that particular aspect of the film and how Wilder was, to your point, he's also had to deal with the ludicrous and completely capricious ratings board and sort of public morals aspect of getting your film scripts approved. And he delighted in withholding and baiting them and sort of playing the game with them so that he could end up doing exactly what he wanted to do.
Right.
And that was a big problem for the board where they were sort of questioning him, like, what are you getting at here with this chimp and this funeral? And like, you know, let's remember, this is far before Michael Jackson and being friends with a chimp is in the public consciousness at all. And right. So, yes, Brad, it's Billy Wilder. You know his vulgar, you know where he wants to go. I mean, he has a crude sense of humor.
So Norma, it wasn't enough for her to be with like truly unevolved humans. She had to be with a literally unevolved human.
I mean, yes, I think that's clearly the implication is that she had and had feelings for this chimp that are beyond those of a pet.
Because it couldn't talk back?
Maybe.
I mean, maybe that's what
I don't
is.
Know. She don't seems know. To value erudition so much. I would be surprised if she found a fulfilling relationship with a chimp because I think the verbal badinage has to be part of what Norma Desmond would be into in a man. That's why she likes Joe. Did.
I mean, Joe came and, you know, she got her next chimp. You
that's
know?
True.
And
I guess so. Maybe that's more the illusion Wilder is kind of making is that Joe Gillis is... He could be swapped for a monkey, you know?
Well, that's the illusion I thought he was making.
Right.
What's that?
As writers could feel in Hollywood.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Oh yeah. I've often said, you know, to anyone who listened that I'm a monkey chained to a typewriter taking dictation.
And of course she had a pool. Who didn't then? Mabel Norman and John Gilbert must have swum in it 10,000 midnights ago. And Vilma Bankey and Rod LaRocque. It was empty now. Or was it? There was something else going on below. The last rites for that hairy old chimp. Performed with the utmost seriousness. As if she were laying to rest an only child. Was her life really as empty as that? It was all very queer. But queerer things were yet to come.
I mean, this nails what it feels like to be a writer in Hollywood. But very often you do feel like a monkey chained to a typewriter taking dictation, which is what Joe is, you know, metaphorically and literally. So this nails that aspect of Hollywood. I have to say, this nails every aspect of Hollywood. It's not exaggerated. That's what the layperson watching is not going to get.
Right.
Yes, it feels like a grand guignol, but it's not. I assure you.
It's happening right now. It's happening the week after the Oscars somewhere. Some writer, some poor SOB writer is getting a note right now after whatever film, you know, sweeps the Oscars And their script, which has absolutely nothing to do with historical events of nuclear fission and world politics, is being given some note on their romantic comedy to, you know, could we put something in there that kind of gets us into the realm of theoretical physics, maybe? And the poor slob is sitting there, you know, learning.
Or the old, you know, chestnut. Can you make him more likable? That's the thing. Christopher Nolan is getting that note right now. I guarantee it. He doesn't have to listen to it anymore, but he's getting it. I mean, the fun thing about this movie and what I've noticed even in LA is it's not exaggerated that you could be racing down down Sunset Boulevard or down Santa Monica Boulevard, pull into a driveway, and whether it's a house or an apartment building that you run up into and pick a random apartment, go into, find somebody who had some former glory in Hollywood. It's all over the place. Yeah. And it's actually one of the most interesting and fascinating aspects of it. You know, at any general party, you can meet the guy who was, Morgan Freeman is a bad example, but, you know, if Morgan Freeman hadn't become Morgan Freeman and he had just stuck around in Hollywood and hadn't made all the movies he did, you go to a party and you meet Easy Reader from the electric company. Right. It's like, 40 years ago, I was Easy Reader. Yeah. Those people are all over LA. They have very interesting stories. And that's what makes the town sort of fascinating.
Right.
But there are Normas in every house, in every apartment.
Yeah. And I found myself watching, when I was watching it again for the first time, when Joe's, it's ironic because Joe's fortunes do change in a way that he could have followed through on. Like, there's a pathway out for him, which he just simply has to follow. It doesn't have to end the way that it does. That's the brilliance, I guess, of the construction of the film, is that Wilder sets up this guy that you come to root for in the way that you do a noir, you know, detective, essentially. He's the detective-like character in the construct of the noir. He just happens to be a film writer. And when he when he meets, I can't remember her name, but the fresh-faced blonde.
Betty Schaefer.
Yeah. She's saying, here's a way out. Let's work on this. And they spark together and they're doing good work. And that great sequence actually filmed in the sort of writer's rooms, I guess, is it the Paramount?
The bungalows. Yeah. The interesting thing about Joe is Billy Wilder had the guts to make him an asshole. Joe is a full on jerk and he gets in his own way. He's got a massive chip on his shoulder. Maybe that comes from being a journalist who thought he was doing God's work or something. But he comes out there, thinks it's going to be, and a lot of people do, thinks it's going to be a breeze. I can write these stupid little stories and make my fortune. And he doesn't. He finds that it's incredibly hard work. You actually have to deal with people and, you know, be able to maintain relationships. And Joe's a complete jerk. When he sees the ability to use Norma to get what he wants, he uses her, but he's not smart enough to know, he's not smart enough to follow through on that, which is, I could stay here, help her write her scripts, be a kept man for a year and write any X number of scripts, you know, with my benefactor as I want to. And he could maybe do it that way. He could ply his trade by being a kept man, but he doesn't do that. Mm. He wants to...
He wants
it all. And then what does he do? He leaves there and, you know, he steals this other guy's girl, you know, just because he feels like it. Joe's a jerk.
Which, by the way, it was only until I was reading this damn book last night, I didn't even realize that her fiance is played by Jack Webb.
Oh.
Did you realize
interesting.
That?
The Dragnet guy?
Yes.
Oh, that's funny. No, I didn't realize
he's completely opposite what you think of when you think of him.
Yeah. That's so funny.
There's a whole long section in this book, which is really good. It goes into great, great granular detail about a lot of tangential things. Like it tells you the whole Jack Webb fascinating life story and acting story and sort of what he was like personally, you know, all connected to Sunset Boulevard, which is really what's cool about the book, is it digresses in these ways that you wouldn't expect.
That's interesting. The other thing that really struck me watching the movie again, and I'm sure your listeners want to hear more, factoids about the movie. But the thing that struck me is interesting.
No, they want to hear more humiliating stories from you about being a writer in Hollywood. That's what they really want.
Oh, I got
them. So
I got plenty of them. So but what's interesting about Billy Wilder is, if you notice, all of the people, all the characters in this movie, from the writers to Norma to everybody are absolutely awful, except the directors. The directors are these kind, right, giving, understanding, yes, people. You know, Norma obviously is absolutely mad as a hatter. Mm-hmm. Joe is a user. Betty Schaefer is only using Joe so she could, you know, become a, you know, because she likes his story, so she can like learn from him.
Oh, I don't
and
think she's
a
using. They're in love.
Okay.
Come
so
on,
say they're in
so
love.
Cynical,
she's got a
Brad.
Fiance too. She's two-timing her fiance. That's not great either. You know, you could, you know, any two people can fall in love at any moment. You know, these people have no morals and no value system. But the only person who's kind in this really is Cecil B. DeMille.
True.
The big director.
Who's and like, Max at the end when he directs her and doesn't pop the bubble of her lurid fantasy. So you're right. It's funny when you were talking about writers, I was thinking in my mind, I was like, well, is it also Billy Wilder's kind of comment on other writers in a way? Like he's kind of putting them down in the Joe Gillis character. And you're totally right that, and actually thank God for that, the C.B. DeMille section, which as I understand it, Gloria Swanson had to kind of fight to have in the film because she wanted her character, as many actors do, to be more humanized and to be more multidimensional and less this, you know, bizarre caricature, her claw-like hands, which I just think is such a wonderful touch. But that,
yes,
I love.
She played it very down to earth.
I love that sequence. I think it's handled really, really well. And I'm there for the empathy, the rare empathy, I think, that Wilder shows as a director in allowing her to have that moment with Cecil B. DeMille and the way that's done and framed. That's my favorite part of the film, actually.
No, but I must apologize for not calling you.
You'd better. I'm very angry.
Well, you see, I'm terribly busy.
That's no excuse. You read the script, of course.
Yes, I did.
Then you could have picked up the telephone yourself instead of leaving it to one of your assistants.
Hmm? What assistant?
Now, don't play innocent. Somebody named Gordon Cole.
Gordon Cole?
And if you hadn't been pretty darn interested in that script, he wouldn't have tried to get me on the telephone 10 times.
Gordon Cole. Norma, I'm in the middle of a rehearsal. Now, why don't you just sit up here in my chair and make yourself comfortable, hmm?
Thank you.
That's a girl. Yeah. I won't be a moment. Bring me a telephone and get me Gordon Cole.
Right.
Hey, Miss Desmond. Miss Desmond. It's me. It's Hawkeye.
Hello, Hawkeye.
Let's get a good look at you.
Look, there's Norma Desmond.
Norma Desmond. Norma Desmond.
Why, I thought she was dead.
How Jude. Nice to see you.
Welcome home, mister. You remember me, don't you?
Miss Desmond.
Hello.
Hello,
Professor.
Oh,
it's so
Wilhelmsen. Have you met Miss Desmond?
It's a great pleasure. Oh, Gordon, this is C.B. DeMille. Have you been calling Norma Desmond?
Yes, Mr. DeMille. It's that car of hers, an old Isotta Fraschini. Her chauffeur drove it in on the lot the other day. It looks just right for the Crosby picture. We want to rent it for a couple of weeks.
Oh, I see. Well, thank you very much. Thank you.
But I think that's such the best part of the film. And I love the way Cecil B. DeMille played it. And I just love the reception that, like, they gave her this moment, which is nice, I think. So I really
they have gotten part. Cecil B. DeMille if they hadn't assured him that he was going to get to be the moral center of this movie.
I don't know, because, you know, I don't know how written out that was prior to filming it that day.
Right.
You know, a lot of this stuff was not completely put down in script form before everything was shot. So I'm not sure, because I know at least...
Oh, is that true?
Yeah, it well, was in, not- in this book, they're talking a lot about how, you know, things come up and, you know, Gloria Swanson is pressing them to, you know, include, to play the sequence differently. Because I think as originally conceived, it was yet another humiliation for her in going to the studio. And you can see the framework of the humiliation where they only want her for the car, they're not calling for her, all these aspects of the scene that are intact. But the way she and DeMille played it, and his, more importantly than what he does with her, because he's caring and gentle with her in the scene, But it's also what he says to other people about her when she's not present in earshot. That's an important backstop to that sympathy for people really such as himself really at that time in his own career. So that's like another.
Well, it's Billy Wilder acknowledging what the business does to people, which is it, you know, it chews you up and spits you out if you're in it for the wrong reasons. If you don't make yourself remember that you're there for the work and the art of it, and it's not about relevancy. Mm-hmm. It's not about recognition, because chasing relevancy and recognition is poison. Right. It's absolutely poison. And people, you know, it destroys people. I mean, I've seen that happen too. Well, you have to remember that it's just about hard work and creativity at the end of the day, and it doesn't matter what anyone else thinks.
Here's a question for you. I've been pondering this as I'm pondering the fictional relationship between Rick Dalton and Cliff Booth in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
As one does.
And thinking also about the real lives as we know them as fans from the outside of Leonardo DiCaprio and Brad Pitt and their respective, you know, decades in the business and where they are now. And what I'm wondering is, when you go to Hollywood, where do you pick up the unspoken kind of advice, rules of the road, how to navigate the business, how to navigate the pitfalls? Like, where does that stuff come up? I've never really seen that. Like, you'd have to imagine that at some point, like when they're doing A River Runs Through It, that Redford and Pitt have a moment where, like, maybe Redford goes like, okay, here's how you avoid these pitfalls and problems. Like, recently this came up where, in a somewhat joking fashion, Timothy Chalamet was relating career advice that Leonardo gave him. And the reporter said, what was the advice? He said, no superhero movies, no hard drugs. And it's just such a brilliantly boiled down piece of advice. Like, where do you get that advice? Like, is it sitting at lunch with Billy Wilder or other
it's
writers?
Also, like, that's a good soundbite. It's also very reductive.
Yeah, of course.
you can't make a career off those two pieces of advice. They're fine. Where do you get advice about how to avoid the pitfalls of Hollywood?
Yes.
Where do you get the advice about how to avoid the pitfalls of life? I mean, you have to choose who you listen to, and you have to choose who you know, if you think someone's been chewed up and spit out, do you take that person's advice? Do you think they're going to be the ones who are going to give you good advice? I don't know. They probably have advice about how to avoid those pitfalls by not, you know, by avoiding the things that they did. And maybe you go the opposite direction that they did. I'm not sure that there's any one place. You know, you absorb everything you can and you use your best judgment. But the most important thing really is just buy your trade. I mean, that's all you can do.
What percentage of conversations that you have about the work that you do are about subtly politically navigating the possible roads ahead for a project?
Oh, gosh. I don't. I'm very much a keep my own counsel kind of person. I like the people in this business. I'm a fairly non-cynical person. Mm-hmm. I'm also a realist about, you know, what everybody wants. But in the end, Hollywood really is just a working class town in the sense that, yes, there are people who want the power that come off mm-hmm. of success, but they also just want to keep doing what they're doing and they want to make good work and they want to keep doing it every day. So, you know, the best advice I ever got from anyone is the way you make a career is you keep doing it every day. Mm-hmm. Whatever you do, just keep doing it every day. In one capacity or another. I didn't know that this was what this podcast was going to be about.
Hey, I'm just going where
just
the movie takes us.
We're having a conversation about Hollywood.
Well, because that's what the film is about. And I think it's about how you handle situations, which, as we both know, you know, when you have millions of dollars at stake and you have things like studios or networks, you have expectations, you have executives. I can't remember where I read it, but there's a brilliant quote where Soderbergh was responding to a executive's note on one of his films. And he said something like, oh, I'm sorry. I didn't understand. You were mistaking an idea you had for a creative thought, which is like some withering, like amazing put down. But in my line of work, I have to take the counsel of at least one other person who I kind of chew over, you know, how are we going to respond to this request from the network, right? Mm-hmm. Because left to my own devices, I would probably be more of a Joe Gillis crash and burn type poor decision maker. And sometimes I have to listen to someone else who goes like, okay, totally get it. Let's think about this. And I have to step back. I had to learn to do that. That was kind of my question. I mean, maybe you're lucky enough where you, your own counsel in your mind is a compass that you learn. You can just kind of follow without being rude about it or impolite. You can just simply stick to your guns or say no or handle it any number of maybe more sophisticated ways, let's say.
Yeah, because what I've discovered is the great majority of people in this industry, whether it's executives who are giving you a note, or producers giving you a note, or whatever, are really just trying to make things better. Right. Whether they go about it the right way or not, you know, as another artist, I can choose to react to it, you know, from a place of, you know, angry reactivity, mm-hmm. or go, oh, this person's just trying to make it better, and this might not be the way to do it, or maybe it is. But why should I alienate this person? You know, they're a fellow film worker, as the mm-hmm. term goes. For me, it's interesting. You know, going back to our Ed Wood thing, there was that play that they do at the beginning of Ed Wood in the middle of Hollywood, the sort of cut rate play. I've been to any number of those plays. I've done a few myself. You know, I did one in Hollywood in 1999 on Ivar called Moon Children, you know, and we used to go to a great bar that I don't know if it's there anymore, but it was a very famous bar going all the way back to the 50s, maybe the 40s. It was on Cahuenga West. It was called the Casting Office. Mm. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, but it was a place where, you know, character actors, you know, all these people went and they would sit around and drink and talk about the roles that they had in this, that, or the other thing. There was a guy that I did this play with, a guy named Clem. I can't remember his name, but he had worked for like 50 years, you know, in Hollywood. And he had worked as recently as Magnolia. Mm. He played one of the guys at the very beginning of Magnolia in the vignettes who shoots the person through the window or something like that. Anyway, he was in this play and he was telling me all about his life in Hollywood. And these guys would go there and tell you about their lives in Hollywood. And you realize at a certain point that many of them were trying to chase other people's approval. Mm. That was what it was all about, that they didn't have a baseline for their art, that it was about chasing jobs, chasing approval, getting up
actors,
every day.
And, Brad?
They're actors. And that's totally understandable. But at a certain point, you have to realize that you have to develop your own inner sense of, you know, what you want, who you are, what you're doing, and what's right and wrong in the art that you're making, and follow that. And that's the path to success, in my opinion, in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. Not to say that all of these people are not fascinating and entertaining and make up the rich tapestry of what Hollywood is and what we always want it to be. But it's a tough place to make a living.
Yeah.
It's a tough place to make a living.
And I wanted to ask you also about Stroheim in Sunset Boulevard, because he's another, his casting, he's just not up to the acting for me that Bill Holden and Gloria Swanson are. I appreciate
him. He's Tor Johnson. You got to have your Tor Johnson in
Hollywood.
That's
true. I guess I didn't think about it. I didn't make that connection. But what's fascinating, though, reading about his life is crazy and amazing. This guy would turn in rough cuts of pictures that were 9 and 12 hours long. Literally. Yeah. Like, for what's supposed to be films in the 20s and the 30s in Hollywood, he was so out of his mind that he would turn in like 50 reels. And
wow.
And it's an incredible story. He added the Vaughn in his name for like aristocratic post-war, you know, Germanness to come through.
Amazing.
There's so many amazing stories in them. And he very capably performs this role. And actually, I hadn't seen the film in so long that it totally worked on me, where I didn't, until he revealed to Joe that he was her first director, and he was married to her and grew her career up. And now he's, you know, the driver, the butler, the valet. That totally worked
for
me.
Well, he's like everyone in the movie, and very specifically in this house. He's a ghoul haunting the house who will never leave. You know, he's a ghoul. And that's, you know, that, and Hollywood is full of that too.
I just wanted, I found myself just wishing they could all find a happy medium with each other. Like, I didn't want it to end the way it did. I wanted them all. Like, I love the what is she called? The Waxworks, who come over with Buster Keaton, and
he calls them the Waxworks, which fits into my he's a total asshole.
You're right. You're right. Buster Keaton, by the way, there's one shot of him. He doesn't have any lines really, but that face. I mean, that shows you what a movie star is to me.
Absolutely.
That's just
old,
like,
stone face. That was his nickname.
But just the eyes, it's like, it's so expressive. It's so unique. There's nothing like it. And even just that one cutaway that there is when they're playing cards, yeah, it just reminds you what a star is. But yeah, I think
he doesn't have to say anything to project empathy.
He does not.
And a life. Yeah.
And you know, my cynical heart in the noir sense, I want those, I always buy in. I always want, at the 2/3 mark of the film, I want everyone to just, this is probably my own broken family history as a child. I just want everyone to figure out a way where we can, okay, we had some moments here, but let's figure out a way to go forward here together. It's for the betterment of all of us. But of course, no, it all has to fall apart.
I mean, the film has to follow its own trajectory.
I know. It just bothers me when why can't it follow a different trajectory at times?
The good news is Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is right there for you.
You're right.
You need it.
That is. I think that's why I'm obsessed with it, probably.
Yeah.
Is because it does offer, you know, remember all the criticism the film got for like negating the brutality of the Manson murders by putting forth this alternative version of what could have happened, and that somehow was a historical crime that people were upset that Tarantino had committed. But again, at what I just said, that's why that works in my heart, is like, yes, I want these two kind of has-beens to be the reason these terrible things don't happen. And had that happened, maybe Rick Dalton could have, who is also an asshole, by the way, and to your point about Joe Gillis, like Rick Dalton is not let off the hook, even though there's a humanity that Leo brings to him in his darkest moments. But
I don't know if Rick Dalton is an asshole. I would say he's a narcissist.
True.
You know, just like Norma is.
That's
Norma
true.
Is not a bad person. She's a toxic narcissist, and Joe is an asshole.
I guess that's true. I think there's a lot of choices in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood that I think show you that if you're not paying attention to what you were talking about finding your own kind of moral compass through things without even really realizing it, you're a guy, like I mentioned in the Rick Dalton podcast, who throws his trash on the floor of the set and doesn't even pick it up. Yeah. Why? Because when he was a star, he never had to worry about that, I guess.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, Tarantino ends the movie with Rick Dalton being an asshole on the set of the Red Apple commercial in the post-credit sequence. So even then, when we're feeling warm and fuzzy about Rick and his career prospects, because he's been allowed through the gates of the Polanski compound, and Sharon Tate is heard in the last line of the film saying, "Oh, he's a wonderful actor," and you're thinking, "Wow, he's right. He's one pool party away from becoming relevant again." And then the film post credits shows him squandering it in the Bounty Law era by kicking over the cut out of himself. It's just such a hilarious choice.
You may have just blown my mind. Is there a post credits sequence in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
Yes.
I don't think I stuck around long enough to find that out.
Well, yeah, it's actually kind of mid credits, but there's a Red Apple cigarettes commercial.
Hi, this is Rick Dalton, better known as Bounty Hunter Jake Cahill, speaking on behalf of Red Apple Cigarettes. Now, I smoke Red Apples, been smoking them for years, but since the Red Apple Tobacco Company's been around since 1862, you'll see Jake Cahill smoke Red Apple too. Now, back in Jake's day, Red Apple came in a pouch and he had to roll his own. But today, Red Apple comes factory rolled for the best drag with the best tobacco flavor with less burn on your throat than any other non-filter cigarette. Mm. Well, that's the way a cigarette should taste. Better drag, more flavor, less throat burn. That's the Red Apple way. So look for this life-size standee of me, Jake Cahill, wherever fine Red Apple tobacco products are sold. Take a bite and feel all right. Take a bite of a Red Apple. Tell him Jake sent you. And cut. All right, this cigarette tastes like fucking shit. And by the way, who chose this photo, all right? I have a double chin, all right? Nobody notices that crap.
It's so good.
Amazing. Amazing. So there's what the audience gets and the truth behind it.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think that's the genius of Sunset Boulevard too, is that it commits to that and it goes there. And it is kind of crazy that Wilder was able even to get away with it. But probably enabled by his history and his dominance as a director. I mean, he's probably the first celebrity director, really. Well, no, I guess you had Howard Hawks and you had, you know, John Ford and, but I'm not sure what their profile was in the public eye in their era.
It wasn't. They were workmen. You know,
they were working, right? Yeah.
Yeah. They were they were considered great journeyman directors until you know the movie brat era of the 60s or early 70s when people started studying directors and
right.
And then they became, you know,
Hawksian became a thing.
Yeah.
But Wilder was so colorful, I guess he could not help but become, you know, a subject of gossip pages and, you know, variety reports and Hedda Hopper and all of that's kind of part of the business, which is in the movie too. Like she's in the movie as herself, which is brilliant. You know, like
I remember hearing a story a while ago. I don't know if it was Hedda Hopper or one of the other gossip columnists or somebody from one of the studios, but somebody was very angry at him for having written the script of Sunset Boulevard. And the fact that he was trying to make it.
I think someone cursed him out. And it was even like at the Academy Awards or something. It was like at a place where you would think it would be.
Now tell me something. Why would they do that if he was not holding up a mirror? An absolutely accurate mirror.
Of course. Well, because you have to remember these people running studios were coming out, were still in a period where their whole way of life was threatened by the external force of the government. You know, and the House Un-American Activities Committee. And these guys, I mean, talk about a money funnel going up to, you know.
Was that happening in 49? That wasn't happening in 49. That was like mid-50s, the HUAC.
But I mean, I think this is you're starting to see the beginnings of it with the attention paid to Hollywood and the product being put out and the morals and all this kind of stuff. It's like, again, a lot of the things that would start to happen, it's like anything in Hollywood, right? Like, or anything in any business. Once you're at a very peak of success, it's like the arrows start coming in and people start wanting to get their claws into your business and what you're doing. And so
I think they were more concerned, Jack Warner, my understanding, my reading of that story was that they thought he was making fun of them.
Well, he was.
Yeah.
He's like, congratulations.
He was making fun of them by literally just holding up a mirror.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
He's like,
situation, like that scene with Sheldrake when he goes in with Sheldrake and, you know, Sheldrake has like this secretary bringing him a milk of magnesia and, you know, he's talking about how I can't lend you any money. Yeah. I can't lend you any money because I bought this thing and now I have this thing to pay that thing to
That's
everyone's
so
over leveraged. It's all an illusion.
It's so good. And I also love the scene where he goes to see his agent on the golf course. And full of bonhomie, the agent's like, oh, my dear boy, of course I could lend you $300. I won't, of course, because I think hunger is good for you as a writer. You know, I want you home writing. I don't want you out gambling and spending this in the bars. I want you home with nothing to do, nowhere to go, nothing to spend the money on. So I won't give you the money.
Yeah,
so great. Funny.
Everyone ultimately hates the writer because everybody.
You mean in a film?
In Hollywood, everybody hates the writer because they realize that they need him.
Yeah,
they're
exactly.
mad at the writer because at the fundamental, you know, core, they need him. The agent needs him. The producer needs him because they need scripts and they need pages. The actor needs them for their lines or to rewrite their lines. The studio needs him. So, you know, they're considered the lowest of the low, but also the most integral.
Right.
So everybody hates you.
Yeah. What do you have without the writer? That's the mirror he's held up.
And they hate to... people hate to need somebody. Everybody wants to feel like they're independent, like they could do it.
Right.
But you need the writer. You need the words and you need the story.
Well, that's why I like a collaborative idea. That's why I reflexively fall in line with the Pauline Kaels of the world, which is sort of like, it's more corrosive to subscribe to the auteur theory than it would be to understand, as you pointed out, that we have to have a captain and we have to have someone in charge in the director. But that every film I love is always apparent to me that this is the work of a large team of craftspeople, a few key players of which in terms of casting, cinematography, editing, production design, screenwriting, directing, cinematography, et cetera. I always feel like I can see those contributions and feel them working together in the films that I love and appreciate the most. It still bothers me when I see a Quentin Tarantino film. Sure. I just don't like that. I just think directed by is great.
It's nuanced though. It is nuanced. You know what I mean? It's not, I don't believe in the auteur theory either, but I also believe that certain directors have a style that leads through all of it, and they are the ringleader for that style.
Absolutely.
They bring everything together, all the different departments. But that doesn't necessarily take away from the craftspeople's contributions in any way.
No,
I think it's nuanced. It's a nuanced conversation.
What are the other Wilder films you love?
Oh gosh, The Apartment.
Really?
Is at the very, very top? Yes, because it's such a bitter love story. Mm. It's such a corrosive love story. And I think that was probably the first time, you know, anybody had the female lead, the ingenue, try to commit suicide over a failed love affair, which, you know, it was very daring for its time.
Well, I mean, Gloria Swanson tried it in Sunset Boulevard in 19...
But she didn't. That was not a real suicide attempt.
Well, she slashed,
let's be honest.
She slashed her wrist.
I have had narcissists in my life threaten suicide. I have run to their side. They were half-hearted attempts.
It was a film star version, right?
What's that?
It was the film star version of a suicide attempt.
Yes.
Like,
it was really just the fainting couch version to bring him back to her, to manipulate him back, which is what narcissists do.
Right,
you know, poor me, woe is me.
Yes.
You know, and it's a great thing. But Shirley MacLaine's suicide is, she takes a whole lot of pills to try and just go to sleep forever because she's heartbroken.
Yeah.
You know, so it's, there are two different suicides, but yes.
Okay. I really liked, I'm really into A Foreign Affair because I think I did an episode recently about The Third Man, and I got really into a very obscure corner of cinema, which is films shot in actual war-torn World War II cities, of which Third Man is one, and A Foreign Affair is one because it's partially shot in Berlin, and you have the rubble and the wreckage of the real consequences of the war, which infuses the film. Even a Billy Wilder film, which is very different than obviously the Carol Reed approach in something like The Third Man. And the Graham Greene aspect of that, you have sort of a more European sensibility, you have more of a British sensibility. You have a different kind of level of things going on in a film like that than you do in Sunset Boulevard or in A Foreign Affair in a way. But even with that, it's still demonstrably a Billy Wilder film, but I can feel that undercurrent of what it must have been like for Billy to be there in Berlin. And it comes into the film in unexpected ways in a great way. I really, really like that film. And
I have to go back and see it. I haven't seen A Foreign Affair in a long time.
It became
the earliest Billy Wilder film I can remember seeing now, and I don't even think this was that early, was it wasn't Ninotchka, it was The Lost Weekend. That's in the 40s, right? The Ray Milland one?
Yeah, the Lost Weekend is after Sunset Boulevard. I think it's...
Oh, is it?
I think it's 52. I watched all of the... you're right. The Lost Weekend is 1945, so it's before...
You'll find that I'm usually
right. You're usually right. I know.
Because I'm from Hollywood.
You're from Hollywood. You're always right. Damn writers. No wonder people don't like writers. They're always right.
I don't like myself sometimes. Speaking of The Third Man, and this is apropos of nothing, we're just digressing,
all
over the place in this podcast. But I finally took my pilgrimage, because I love The Third Man, to Vienna this past December, the top of January.
Wow.
I did two pilgrimages. I did one to Salzburg and saw all of the Sound of Music locations, which are completely intact. But then we went to Vienna and I saw all of the Third Man locations, which are completely intact. We went
the doorway.
I rode the Reason Rod. Which was great. I have pictures of me in front of the first apartment that Joseph Cotton goes to stay with the giant statues framing the thing. Mm-hmm. They're all still there.
Amazing.
Yeah, amazing. The Interstate looks exactly the same, except for Starbucks.
Did you hear the Zither soundtrack playing anywhere in your travels?
I did.
Or just in your head, or like coming out of a cafe or something?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it feels that way. It really does. That vibe is intact. That's what's amazing. Great about Europe.
Yeah. Well, check out A Foreign Affair again. I'm really interested also in the film star Jean Arthur, who plays the Iowa congresswoman who falls in love with the military guy who's having a secret affair with Marlena Dietrich. And I don't know much about Marlena Dietrich before getting to that film and hadn't really watched many of her films. But man, that's a movie star too. Like that, there is a certain thing that the pieces and the parts don't make the kind of sense you think a movie star is supposed to look like in a way. But when she's on the screen, it's like Tarantino says of Brad Pitt, when he looks through the viewfinder and Brad is in a scene, he's not looking through the viewfinder. He feels like he's looking at a movie. That's one of the best descriptions I've ever heard of what a movie star is.
It's a quality you can't learn.
All would learn it, wouldn't they?
No, it's true. I mean, you can go to acting school for your entire life and never learn how to hold a camera.
Yeah.
You can never shape your face into the thing that the camera loves.
Yeah.
That is a gift from God, you know? Wait, so do I have it right? Did you not like this movie at the end of the day? You at least enjoyed watching it, whether you think it's a work of art or not. How can you not enjoy watching the spectacle, the grandiosity, the over-the-topness of this movie? It's a joy.
Can I tell you what I came away with is?
Wait, do you hate joy, Jason? And why do you hate
joy? Don't paint me into my own corner. Let me do that myself. You know what I came out as? I don't think Billy Wilder is a very good director.
Wow. That is a hot take.
Not just on Sunset Boulevard, just watching a lot of these movies. I think he's a competent director, but I never saw a shot that I was impressed with particularly.
Is that what makes a good director to you? The shots, the style?
Well,
I'm not asking cynically. I'm asking because, you know, some people could say if you can tell a good story and not be flashy, then you're a good director. But then again, you have somebody like Sidney Lumet, who is not flashy, but is a great director, who I know you like.
Two of my favorite directors are Sidney Lumet and Alan J. Pakula, both of whom are accused of not being flashy or cinematic in those ways. So no, it's just that in watching, again, a lot of Billy Wilder films, I understand why they are what they are. And I understand for his time how kind of envelope pushing many of these films were, and some of them remain. So I have full appreciation for it. It's just kind of not what I dig of the era. Mm-hmm. So for example, if I watch The Third Man, am I at home in everything cinematically going on in a film like that? Whereas when I'm watching Sunset Boulevard, I kind of can see it working. And it may just be watching too many movies. Like I'd have to put myself in the mindset of watching it then would probably be a unique and mind-blowing experience.
Well, The Third Man has a very angular German expressionist palette.
Yes.
You know, Billy Wilder is doing a much more meat and potatoes, you know, play to all the back audiences, play to middle America as possible.
Yes.
But he's also being stealth because he's feeding them, you know, he's
feeding them acid.
He's feeding the masses, but he's also feeding them like...
No, I meant acid, not masses.
He's feeding them acid without them realizing what they're eating.
And I appreciate
which
that.
Which is sort of... Yeah.
I do appreciate that. It's just not... Yeah. It's just... I didn't... Like, for example, in The Lost Weekend, right?
Yeah.
Subject matter I'm interested in. I can appreciate it, but I'm watching and I'm like, oh, wait, this isn't what I thought. I realized I was thinking of Days of Wine and Roses with Jack Lemmon.
Sure.
Which is... to me, a superior film about basically the same subject. And that kind of in a nutshell is the difference that I can't quite articulate perfectly about why he just doesn't really do it for me. However, I did love A Foreign Affair the most, and I also loved Witness for the Prosecution, which...
And my understanding is you're a closet buddy-buddy fan.
What's Buddy Buddy? Is that the late?
Buddy,
that...
Buddy Buddy was his last movie in 1981.
I did him the favor of not watching that.
Okay, that's good. That's good.
Unless you're going to defend that, I was like, Buddy Buddy's actually good.
I haven't seen it in a lot of years. Okay. I think I saw it when it came out, and I was 7 years old. But
no, I didn't see. Is Jack Lemmon in that too?
He is. Jack Lemmon. and Matthau.
And Matthau. Okay. Well, yeah, that's got to be watchable at least. I mean, you can't go wrong with the two of them together.
You know what? Billy Wilder was a journeyman Hollywood director that snuck in some of his acerbic wit to very meat and potatoes movies.
I agree.
I think that's what he was.
I agree.
And that's okay.
Yeah.
You know, that's okay. Like who would you consider great directors
Hitchcock.
From this era?
Hitchcock.
Oh, Hitchcock. Yeah.
You know, I watched, I watched a Hitchcock film I hadn't seen. God, what the hell?
I don't know. I'm not that familiar with his.
I'm not a huge Hitchcock guy either. But this one,
I mean, my hot take is I actually prefer Brian De Palma over Hitchcock. And I know Brian De Palma stole everything he ever did from Hitchcock, but I think it's just an age thing. And I love Hitchcock.
Yeah.
But in terms of pure pleasure, which is how I rank how I watch movies.
Yeah. I want to give you the name of this Hitchcock film because I think you would really like it. So, yeah.
I love how this conversation became less of a, you know, cutting into the movie than a digressive conversation about Hollywood in general.
Well, but you know, in general, I think a great movie takes you places other than the movie itself. And that's what I think is inspiring us here.
You don't think this movie is full of fantastic dialogue? He was a smart producer with a set of ulcers to prove it. I mean,
okay, but yes. But here's the thing: what I don't like is I don't like when characters in a film all sound like the writer. And to me, Sunset Boulevard falls a little bit into that category where they all sound like what we imagine Billy Wilder's sense of humor would sound like. Although I have to say, a lot of that, there's a part in this book. It says, you know, if you listen to Billy Wilder talk, his cadences are not represented in these scripts. This author is kind of putting a lot of stock in saying, like, you know, let's make sure that we're giving Charles Brackett, in the case of Sunset Boulevard, appropriate credit. The wit, the spice, the knife is absolutely Wilder's. But a lot of the dialogue this author is positing, you know, doesn't really come from Billy's way of talking. It comes from Charles Brackett's way of talking, or at least his way of writing. Shadow of a Doubt is the Hitchcock film I watched.
Because
it's got Joseph Cotten. So I wanted to see another Joseph Cotten film after I had done The Third Man. It's really good. It's really good.
I'll have to go back and watch it. I mean, I'm sure I've seen it, but it's been a long time. The funny thing about Billy Wilder being the ultimate contrarian, this is why I feel like you guys are soulmates. But the funny thing about Billy Wilder being the ultimate contrarian is here's a guy who came to the States in the 1930s, right, to escape the Nazis. Mm-hmm. He lived there till he died in the late 90s, so 60 plus years in the United States. In the late 90s, his accent was as thick as it ever was.
Right.
He was this man made no effort to try to flatten out his very thick German accent.
It became part of, it's like the monocle for Stroheim or whatever, right? It's like it's part of your shtick. Sorry, I just misspoke on the Hitchcock film. It's actually Foreign Correspondent from 1940.
Oh, so you love movies with foreign in the title. That's what we've established.
A Foreign Affair, Foreign Correspondent. I mean, anything you put foreign in the title, I'm going to see it. My wife and I are gonna love to see that film. Foreign Correspondent. Okay. I really want you and all the listeners to go see. Find that movie somewhere. 1940, Hitchcock, brilliant. So that's, if I'm looking at a 40s kind of thing, I think that's where I would fall. When you watch that, you'll know more about what I'm talking about than I'm able to articulate in my inarticulate manner. That's what I would say, Brad.
Right. Another movie that feels like a companion piece to this movie that only came out a few years later, I think, is The Bad and the Beautiful. Have you ever seen that one?
No, I haven't seen that.
It's a great Hollywood movie. The Bad and the Beautiful with
1952.
It was 52. It was Kirk Douglas, right? And Gloria Graham, I think, is in it.
Yep. Lana Turner, Kirk Douglas, Gloria Graham.
Was it Vincent Minnelli who directed it?
Vincent Minnelli. Unscrupulous movie producer Jonathan Shields is a child of Hollywood who ruthlessly toils his way to the top of the studio system, discarding movie star Georgia, director Fred Emile, and writer James Lee Bartlow along the way. That sounds like that's my cup of tea.
It's terrific. It's fantastic.
Love that.
Yeah. It's such a good story, and everyone's, you know, and Kirk Douglas is playing it very straight.
Oh, I like that. I like Kirk tamped down a bit. Oh, a Billy Wilder film I do love is Ace in the Hole.
Love Ace in the Hole.
That
is it. Or The Big Carnival, as it used to be called.
That's right. That, talk about dark and cynical. That is a brilliant film. I think Criterion recently released it. I watched it last summer. That has as much to say about our current state of media as anything you could watch now. So that is the mark. That, there are brilliant, brilliant things there. I'm probably unfairly slagging off Billy Wilder.
That's interesting. Well, I will take the counterpoint to your Billy Wilder trashing and say I think he's a phenomenal filmmaker, if not a style maven. He is not a style maven. He might not have a signature visual style, but I do think he has a I think there's a thread that goes through his films, you know, of wit at the very least.
I agree. Much like there is through our podcast together, Brad.
Yeah, I love it. I hope this wasn't too disappointing because we didn't go too deeply into the film. We had sort of a, you know, we digressed quite a lot.
How much is there to talk about the film, really?
This is great. I love talking to you and I love listening to your podcast.
All right, well, let's do it again when you have a moment. And I can't wait to do another movie about making movies with you, Brad.
Thanks, Jason.
So thanks so much for joining me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right, we'll talk soon. Bye-bye.
You got it.